This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Most Americans have parents or grandparents who rely on Medicare, or they're enrolled in the program themselves. Although Social Security is getting the attention now, Medicare may soon be facing an even bigger financial crisis. In the meantime, the new prescription drug benefit goes into effect in January, and it promises to be very confusing. To better understand how Medicare took the form that it did and what problems it's about to face, we invited Jonathan Oberlander to talk with us. He's the author of the book, The Political Life of Medicare. He's an associate professor of social medicine in the School of Medicine at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. He says that Medicare's roots are in the Truman administration proposals for national health insurance in the early 1950s. After years of debate, Medicare legislation was signed by LBJ in 1965. I asked Jonathan Oberlander about the arguments that were made then for and against the program.
The argument for it was simply that health insurance had been spreading among workers in the employed population in the 1940s and early 1950s, and the elderly had been largely left out of that. To us, their parents and grandparents to insurance companies, they're bad risks. So they're very expensive to insure, and they had been left out of it. So that was the argument for it. The argument against it, which was broached mainly by the American Medical Association, was that this was a slippery slope to socialized medicine. And if we started with Medicare, we were going to get a full-blown national health insurance system.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because one of the major arguments that we hear in America against a single-payer national health insurance plan is that it's like the first step to socialism. It's a socialistic program, and that would be terrible. So how did Medicare get around that and get around the label of it being socialistic?
Mainly by picking a really popular group to insure. So they took the elderly, and that wasn't by accident. The United States is the only industrialized country that began its national health insurance system with the elderly. And they picked the elderly because they commanded sympathy. They were uninsured through no fault of their own. So it was harder to oppose that legislation as socialized medicine.
What was the debate over Medicare like in the House and the Senate?
It was very intense. It was very polarized. It was very ideological and very partisan. The Democrats who favored Medicare thought that this made sense. In the 1950s, there was increasing attention to the problems of the elderly in the United States, and it just seemed the logical thing to do, as you had a population over half of whom didn't have any health insurance at all, and yet they were the part of the population that arguably needed health insurance the most. That was their argument. The opponents of the legislation, Republicans and conservative Democrats, said this is too expensive, that this is a illegitimate intrusion of the federal government into the private sector, and again, that this would lead to socialized medicine. And of course, this was during the height of the Cold War when those claims really meant something.
So how did Medicare end up passing?
What really broke the logjam, and you know, they carefully constructed the Medicare strategy to narrow President Truman's original proposal for a comprehensive national health insurance into a plan just for the elderly and linked to Social Security. And they narrowed it, and nevertheless, it took 15 years to get it through. And what really broke the logjam is the 1964 elections, where Lyndon Johnson was elected with huge liberal Democratic majorities in the House and the Senate. And so it's no accident that at the same time you get civil rights legislation and education legislation and anti-poverty legislation, that you also get Medicare in 1965.
The AMA, the American Medical Association, threatened a strike if Medicare was passed. Why were the doctors opposed to Medicare?
You know, if they had known what was going to happen after Medicare was enacted, they wouldn't have threatened to boycott Medicare, because Medicare helped make the American medical profession rich. Beforehand, they were worried about national health insurance, worried about the federal government telling doctors how they should practice medicine. And they had a long record in the 20th century of opposing any expansion of federal authority in healthcare. Medicare was just the latest battle for them. And the president of the AMA during the Medicare debate said that Medicare was nine parts evil and one part sincerity, and that one part sincerity was a significant concession on his part.
So did the Medicare bill as passed take into account some of the doctors' concerns? Were there compromises to make the doctors happy?
Absolutely. The architects of Medicare wanted to show that federal health insurance could work. And they wanted to have a smooth takeoff of the Medicare legislation after it was enacted in 1965. And so they wrote what I call a sort of open check, a blank check policy in a Medicare, that Medicare would pay hospitals and physicians essentially whatever they asked. That, of course, was a recipe for inflation, but it helped assure that physicians and hospitals would participate in the program. Medicare also, from the beginning, contracted mainly with Blue Cross and Blue Shield to administer the program, and that provided a sort of buffer between physicians and the federal government.
Now, what about the pharmaceutical industry? What was its position on Medicare when it was being debated in the 60s?
They really weren't a significant force in American health policy at the time. Prescription drugs were there, but we hadn't had the sort of explosion in prescription drug spending and discovery that we've had in the 1980s and 1990s. So they were sort of on the periphery of the debate.
And what about the health insurance industry?
The health insurance industry also was not as powerful as they are now. As I said, most seniors did not have good health insurance at the time Medicare was enacted. Some did, and certainly one of the alternatives that was discussed at the time was giving a subsidy for seniors to purchase private health insurance as opposed to Medicare providing it. But simply the size of the margins in Congress, the Democratic margins, and the power of the Johnson administration meant that they couldn't get their way.
You said before that Medicare made doctors, helped to make doctors in America rich. How?
By paying them a lot of money and by paying them anything they wanted. And they had a particular formula that paid physicians according to what was the prevailing practice in a community. And, doctors are smart people. I teach doctors. And it didn't take them very long to figure out that if they kept raising their prices, the prevailing rate, so to speak, would keep going up. And that's what they did. And so American healthcare spending was already, so to speak, on fire, but this added significant flames to it.
And how did that in turn affect the funding for Medicare?
Almost from the beginning of the program, Medicare has been in intermittent fiscal crisis. And as early as 1970, people were worried. Senator Russell Long from Louisiana, from the Senate Finance Committee, said that Medicare was, quote, a runaway train. And those concerns over Medicare's affordability, whether it's going to go bankrupt, have really defined the program all the way back for the last 35 years.
How do you think the promise of Medicare has compared with the reality?
I think the reality has fallen short. And I think that's something that's actually not well understood even today. Medicare pays for less than half of the elderly's health care expenses, less than 50%. That's mainly because Medicare doesn't pay for long-term care, until recently didn't pay for prescription drug coverage and a number of other things. The promise of Medicare is really to assure, as people understand it, that the elderly have access to medical care, that their care is paid for, but Medicare doesn't pay for all that care.
Well, there's a whole industry of supplemental insurance that grew up around the things that Medicare didn't pay for. Can you talk a little bit about the effect of these supplemental health insurance plans and how that's affected the whole Medicare system?
Very few people actually have just Medicare. As some analysts have called it, there's Medicare and then there's real Medicare. And real Medicare includes about 30% of the population that has supplemental health benefits from their employers, retiree health benefits. Another 15% of the population or so has Medigap insurance that they buy on the private market. And low-income Medicare beneficiaries have Medicaid. So that helps to fill in a lot of holes. On the other hand, it also creates inequity because it's the wealthier Medicare beneficiaries that really have the better supplemental coverage.
When Medicare was passed in 1965, it sounds like it was, at that point, pretty uncontroversial. And I guess it remained pretty uncontroversial for about three decades. When did the debate around Medicare really kick in again?
Not until 1994. It really had three decades of quiet. And that's mainly because Medicare is a very popular program. It was popular with beneficiaries. It's popular with their children and grandchildren. It's popular with politicians, and it's really the elections of 1994 that helped bring it back into that center of controversy in American politics. The Republicans won majorities in the House and the Senate for the first time in four decades, and their Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, was intent on reforming Medicare. partly that's because it was a symbol of the Great Society, and he wanted to remake it. You know, Medicare, I always call it a sort of programmatic flower child. It is a child, programmatically speaking, of the 1960s, and Newt Gingrich and the Republican leadership wanted to make it into something that looked more like their conservative vision of the welfare state. At the same time, they needed to make substantial cuts in Medicare because they were trying to balance the budget while they were cutting taxes. So they went after Medicare in 1995, and that really has unleashed a whole decade of conflict over the program.
So what were some of the proposals that Republicans in the mid-90s made to change Medicare, and how does that compare with the debate today?
They initially proposed in 1995 cutting $270 billion from Medicare over 10 years, which was an unprecedented amount of money to cut from the program. They also proposed imposing a budgetary cap on what we spend on Medicare, and that's a radical change from what we have come to know as the Medicare program. Medicare is an entitlement. It's really an open-ended spending commitment. And they suggested that we put a budgetary cap that would limit each year what we spend on Medicare. And there were a lot of concerns if we did that, what that would do to access. The other main part of their reform program was moving Medicare beneficiaries into HMOs. There are about 40 million beneficiaries in Medicare right now. And in between now and 2030, that population is going to double to 80 million. And so spending in the program is going to increase substantially, and the stakes of Medicare reform are going to increase along with it. The debate in Medicare reform right now is submerged because everybody is concerned with the implementation of the Medicare prescription drug benefit. But it's not going to be long before we're back on this question of how do we afford Medicare and what kind of Medicare program should we have.
My guest is Jonathan Oberlander, author of The Political Life of Medicare. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jonathan Oberlander, author of The Political Life of Medicare. He's an associate professor of social medicine in the School of Medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Well, let's back up and look at the prescription drug benefit, which actually kicks in January of next year. So that's when people will actually be able to use the prescription drug benefit. Why don't you describe the way that plan works now?
Well, you know, sometimes with laws, you can say they look good on paper and they're not going to work in reality. This law doesn't really look good on paper, so it's difficult to describe. Right now, Medicare beneficiaries have access to a stopgap drug discount card, and that is going to go out of existence. And come this fall, they can sign up for the Medicare drug benefit. It's a voluntary benefit. It's universal, so it's available to all Medicare beneficiaries. Here's how it would work. You would pay on average $35 a month in premium, and we don't know the exact amount because it's going to vary depending on where you live in the country. After you pay that $35 a month, there's a $250 deductible. Medicare then covers 75% of your costs up to about $2,200. After that, there's what has been called the donut hole. And so Medicare actually pays nothing for the next $3,000. And then the coverage picks up again and pays 95% of your costs.
I mean, that's a really confusing system to follow, and it will require a lot of really good bookkeeping from anyone who participates in that. Is this some kind of strange compromise that grew up out of different points of view?
It's a very strange compromise. It is, in part, it's because there is a budgetary limit in Congress on how much Democrats and Republicans were willing to spend. And there was a compromise made. Republicans really didn't want this to be a universal bill. They wanted it only to go to low-income seniors. Democrats wanted it to go for everybody and wanted a much more generous bill. And so they sort of split things in the middle, and they said, we're only going to spend $400 billion. Now, how do we design a drug benefit around $400 billion? Well, they got some people to sit around and they came up with this crazy scheme with the donut hole. Of course, it's all sort of smoke and mirrors because we know now from the revised forecast that the bill is likely to cost over $700 billion in the next decade. So even the compromise really didn't amount to much.
Now, to make this new Medicare prescription drug benefit program slightly more confusing, seniors also have a big choice of prescription drug plans that they can sign up for. Tell us a little bit about how that works.
Yes, they can choose between what's called a prescription drug-only plan. That is, they can stay in the traditional Medicare program, as about 88% of beneficiaries are today, and they can simply choose from one of many competing plans. And we don't know how many plans there will be yet, but there are going to be competing plans across the country. They also have the choice of getting their coverage through a managed care plan, such as an HMO, which would provide them not only their prescription drug coverage, but all their health coverage.
Maybe I'm projecting here, but I always find it kind of challenging to figure out the different HMO plans and which one is best and which one will save you the most money but give you the best care. And when I think of some of the people who I know who are seniors and the problems that they have reading now, or remembering things, figuring out new things, I find it very difficult to imagine them really navigating their way through some of the really difficult choices you have to make. And I'm talking about some of the, let's face it, people are living in their 80s and 90s now, and your abilities sometimes diminish a little bit as you reach those ages.
It's insanity. My parents are turning Medicare age, and I have a lot of relatives in the Medicare age group. And I'm just fearing in the fall that my phone is going to ring off the hook and I don't have any good answers to give them because I'm confused. I can't figure it out either. And, you know, this bill was really, it was a theory in search of a population. And the theory is we should have a competitive healthcare system with a private market and sort of consumer-driven healthcare where people get to choose and they really drive the healthcare system and make it more efficient. And unfortunately, they've imposed this on a population, as you've suggested, that really isn't well-disposed to make those kind of choices. And I and a lot of other people who study this really fear when this becomes reality in January that we're going to have an $800 billion mess on our hands.
Is there any good manual that has been printed yet to help people navigate their way through these choices?
Well, there's an incorrect manual. There have been some stories recently about the federal government producing a guide to Medicare benefits next year that actually has wrong information about the drug benefit, although they're supposedly correcting that. I think what people can do is go to places like the Medicare Rights Center, which has a website, and they have very good information on there about the drug bill, and that will help people navigate through the choices.
What direction is the health insurance industry pushing in?
The health insurance industry has had a sort of uneasy relationship with Medicare. In the early days of the 1990s, there was a sort of gold rush because they thought they could do really well in Medicare. And they did well for a while. But then as managed care more generally faded, their experience in Medicare turned sour. And actually, we had a decline in managed care plans participation in the Medicare program. There's no doubt that they would like a bigger share of the Medicare program, but they don't want all beneficiaries. You know, we should remember that 10% of Medicare beneficiaries account for 70% of Medicare spending. And so if private plans enroll the other 90% of Medicare beneficiaries, they can do pretty well financially. But if they get those 10% that are really sick, they're not going to do well financially. And one of the things we've seen over time is that private plans tend to enroll healthier beneficiaries than the average.
So do you think the debate today about the shape of Medicare and what proportion should be private health insurance versus Medicare for senior citizens, do you think that that debate is basically the same as the original debate around Medicare? Are the different sides basically arguing the same things?
We are back to the original debate. We've come full circle after all this time, after 40 years. There are two differences. One is that we now have managed care as part of that debate, and managed care really wasn't a large alternative in 1965. The other difference is with the coming of the baby boomers, the stakes around that debate are much higher because you're talking about how much is the government going to be willing to spend, how much can it spend for this aging population, and that really wasn't part of the debate in 1965 either.
With what tax money has Medicare been funding, and how have the recent tax cuts that have gone on during the Bush administration, how have those tax cuts affected the funding for Medicare?
Medicare is funded primarily in two ways. The first is payroll taxes, and we all pay 1.45% on top of what we pay for Social Security, and so do our employers. And that funds Medicare hospital insurance. General revenues are used to fund Medicare Part B, which is Medicare physician services, as well as premiums from beneficiaries. The question about the link to broader tax issues is really an important one, and I think often an overlooked point. And that is, the choices that we make in tax policy generally affect the future of Medicare and the future of all our social programs. The tax cuts that we've enacted in 2001 and 2003 and that we're talking about making permanent take money away from general revenue. And that means, quite simply, there is less money there on the table to pay Medicare. And when the baby boomers age into Medicare in 2010 and beyond, we don't have as much money there to pay for them. It's gone.
Jonathan Oberlander is the author of The Political Life of Medicare. He's an associate professor of social medicine in the School of Medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jonathan Oberlander. We've been talking about the past, present, and future of Medicare. The program is facing a potential financial crisis bigger than the one facing Social Security. The new prescription drug benefit plan goes into effect in January. Oberlander is the author of The Political Life of Medicare. He's an associate professor of social medicine in the School of Medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. How does the potential crisis in the funding of Medicare's future compare with the funding problems with Social Security right now?
The irony is we're spending all of our time debating what to do about Social Security, and the funding crisis in Medicare is actually much more serious. And if you look at it going out a few decades from now, Medicare is going to be a more expensive program than Social Security, and there's going to be a much bigger financial gap in it than Social Security, but we're not talking about that crisis at all. Nobody wants to talk about Medicare because we don't know what to do about it. There are no good choices. Social Security, not to suggest that the problems are trivial, but they are quite fixable and they're simple by comparison. The problems in Medicare are of a much bigger magnitude. They are harder to fix. The solutions that are available are not good. And politically, it's much more charged because in Social Security, you don't have physicians and you don't have hospitals and you don't have nursing homes. And every time you talk about cutting Medicare spending, we have to understand we're talking about cutting providers' incomes.
And so can you talk a little bit more about why Medicare is harder to fix than Social Security?
Because of healthcare spending. Social Security is simply a demographic problem. Medicare is compounded. Not only do we have the aging of the baby boomers, and I want to add that I think, and I have a sort of contrarian view here, that the aging of the baby boomers into Medicare is not in and of itself a crisis. It would be a crisis if we didn't have Medicare and we had 80 million seniors without health insurance. That's a crisis. So the fact that Medicare is growing is not by itself a crisis. However, Medicare is part of the most expensive healthcare market in the world. And if you look at the forecast of healthcare spending over time, healthcare costs are going to go up substantially. And that means the Medicare bill is going to go up substantially. And that's why it's a worse problem than Social Security.
So you think that one of the reasons why the debate around Medicare's future hasn't been louder is that a lot of politicians who want to change Medicare and limit funding for Medicare are a little afraid to tamper with it because it could prove to be very politically unpopular. But for those politicians who are challenging Medicare and trying to change it and limit funding to it, how are they taking it on so as to try to limit the amount of political damage that it would cause?
Well, the obvious solution politically is to make changes that nobody understands. And that's part of what was done in the Medicare drug bill in 2003. More long term, I think the goal is to change Medicare from what is called a defined benefit program, where people have a set of benefits that the government assures, to a defined contribution program where they essentially have a voucher and they're responsible for increases in healthcare spending. If you're able to convert Medicare and do it through a sort of complicated formula that people don't quite get into a defined contribution program, you can cut benefits implicitly over time simply by not increasing the amount of the contribution. And that, I think, is really the goal.
Do you have any idea of what the administrative costs are now for handling Medicare and how those administrative costs are likely to change when the new prescription drug plan kicks in January?
it costs about 2%, which is very low in the United States. And in fact, a lot of people would say Medicare should spend a bit more on administration. I don't know how those costs are going to change once we get to the prescription drug benefit, but they certainly should change. And honestly, one of the problems that we're having with the implementation of the drug benefit is Medicare doesn't have an infrastructure across the country to help beneficiaries. There was a lot of attention last year to the 1-800 number and beneficiaries calling in and getting answers on this toll-free line to the government about what they could do. And there's a tremendous need for one-on-one counseling about the choices that we were discussing earlier that they're going to have to make in choosing drug plans, in choosing health plans. I don't think that can be done through a 1-800 number.
One of the provisions within the Medicare prescription drug package that passed and is going into effect is that the government cannot negotiate for discounts with pharmaceutical companies. What were some of the political and economic reasons that that was negotiated into the final package?
The political reason is simply that the drug companies wanted this legislation if it was going to come on their terms. And their terms were, again, hearkening back to Medicare's beginnings, we want a blank check. And they didn't get a total blank check, but something equivalent to it. You also had a number of conservatives in Congress who are sort of uneasy about aggressive federal regulation. And so they didn't want regulation of the drug companies. And I think what's interesting going forward is to see whether that bargain will hold. Now, in the case of hospitals and physicians, it held in Medicare for 20 years. But once you got to 1983, Medicare canceled the blank check that it wrote at the beginning of the program. And my guess would be that even though drug companies are going to make out very well at the beginning of the Medicare drug legislation, over time, the federal government is going to step in and start setting prices for them as well, just as they do with hospitals and physicians.
So what you're talking about with physicians, like initially Medicare would pay doctors whatever fee they charged, but then finally Medicare said, here's what we pay for a procedure, and the doctor needed to accept that.
Exactly right. They enacted a fee schedule, and they did an equivalent thing for hospitals. Now, they shrouded them in these technical formula that nobody could understand and where they could say to people, no, we're not enacting fee schedules. We're just fixing the method of Medicare payment. And they'll probably do the same thing when they get around to this in prescription drugs. But I think you're going to have the same dynamic, which is costs are going to increase. The government is going to say, look, we simply can't afford this anymore, guys. And they're going to start setting prices in prescription drugs.
So do you think that doctors now feel like the Medicare system is good for their profession?
No, it's interesting. If you would have asked that question in 1970 or 1975, physicians probably would have been far happier with Medicare. Since Medicare has started to cut what they pay physicians, not surprisingly, physician satisfaction with Medicare has declined. So there are a lot of physicians who see a heavy, heavy share of Medicare patients. And my guess, if you ask them, they would say, this is an important program, it plays an important role, but boy, we sure wish it paid us more money.
My guest is Jonathan Oberlander, author of The Political Life of Medicare. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jonathan Oberlander, and he's the author of the book, The Political Life of Medicare, and he's an associate professor of social medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. It seems to me there's a lot of ethical questions that underlie the Medicare issue, and I know you're studying social policy and not ethics, but I thought you still might be able to frame some of those issues for us because, I mean, somebody has to pay for the health care of older people unless we expect them to die sooner than they need to or to live like incredibly uncomfortable lives in great pain. So the options are they pay for it themselves, their children and grandchildren pay for it for them, or there's some kind of, you know, Medicare type of system that pays. And I'm talking here, too, about things that Medicare doesn't cover now, like long-term home health care or long-term nursing. And the private policies that do cover that are really exorbitant. So can you talk a little bit about some of the ethical questions that we really have to face as a nation to confront this issue?
I think the defining ethical question around Medicare is, what does it mean for there to be a right in healthcare and to have a right to medical care? In 1965, we essentially established a right to medical care for the elderly in the United States. And now the question has become over time, what does that right mean? Does that entitle you to all the medical care that you want or all the medical care that your doctor wants to give you? Does that entitle you to choose any physician that you want, to go to any hospital that you want? Or should the government or another insurance plan have a right to say, no, if you want to go to a more expensive provider, you've got to pay more out of your own pocket? And I think there's another set of ethical questions that we see right now around Medicare, and that is, should we treat all beneficiaries the same? Or should the government play a lesser role in the health insurance experiences and the medical care of upper-income beneficiaries? And that is a debate that is widening and is going to define Medicare in the next two decades.
And what are the sides of that debate?
Well, we saw a little bit of it in the prescription drug legislation in 2003. As part of that legislation, more affluent beneficiaries are going to pay more in their Part B premiums, that is, their premiums for physician services, than they are right now. So we're introducing what we call income-related premiums into Medicare. On the one side, you have people who support that, who say it's the progressive thing to do. You know, why should we take, when Bill Gates retires, why should Bill Gates pay the same amount of a Medicare premium as a political scientist, to use a low income, a very low income. And people say, look, you know, Medicare is in financial trouble. We've got to get the money from somewhere. Shouldn't we get it from people who can afford to pay? On the other side, you have people who say Medicare's strength politically has always been that it's a universal program. And if you start to make distinctions among beneficiaries, and if you start to charge upper-income beneficiaries more, you're going to unravel the political coalition that has made Medicare the program that it is today.
What are some of the ways that the United States could raise more money to fund the Medicare system? And what are some of the problems that go along with those ways?
A really simple and available way is simply to increase the payroll tax that goes to Medicare. And, you know, we haven't increased that tax since 1986. And there's an interesting political dynamic here. Republicans are opposed to it because they're opposed to raising taxes. Democrats, I think, would like to raise it, but they don't want to be seen as tax and spend liberals. So they're too afraid to raise it. So as a result, nobody is talking about it. In fact, when they had a bipartisan commission to consider Medicare's future over the next 75 years in 1998 and 1999, by agreement with Speaker of the House Gingrich, they were not allowed to consider or discuss an increase in the Medicare payroll tax. And there's no way to double the size of the Medicare program without increasing that tax. That's not a sign that the program is failing or something is wrong. It's simply common sense that the tax has got to go up if more people are enrolling in the program.
Are there other options?
The other options have to do with bringing in more general revenues, of course, and more income-related premiums from wealthier beneficiaries. Some people have discussed in healthcare adding a VAT, a value-added tax. Economists are a huge fan of the value-added tax, but economists don't run for office very often, although we've got a few of them up there in Washington. And so far, the VAT has not caught on in Washington, but we'll see.
We've been talking about Medicare. Let's talk a little bit about Medicaid, which is facing a lot of financial difficulties now. Historically, what is the connection between Medicare and Medicaid?
Medicaid is the stepchild of Medicare. The Medicare debate, which started in 1951, went all the way up, almost to the end in 1965, with virtually no discussion of Medicaid. And in the last few months, Medicaid was actually inserted as part of the Medicare legislation, and it grew out of a program in 1960 called the Kerr-Mills Program, which provided federal money to states to pay for medical care for low-income seniors.
And what are the problems that Medicaid has run into?
Medicaid, in contrast to Medicare, is a welfare program. And historically, it was linked to welfare programs, and its experience has been a bit like that of a seesaw. It went up, and then it would go down, depending on the state of the economy. And when the economy was bad, states would simply knock people off eligibility. They would knock them off the Medicaid program rolls, which is something that can't be done in the Medicare program. Having said that, Medicaid really experienced a sort of renaissance in the late 1980s and in the 1990s. It really grew as a program, and it's no longer so connected to welfare. In fact, about half the people on the Medicaid program at the moment are children. And a lot of the adults that are on the Medicaid program are working adults.
A lot of states are saying they just can't afford the Medicaid bills anymore. So what are the states doing?
The states have a real dilemma, which is they are still in the budgetary hole that they were put in following September 11th, 2001. And while the economy has improved, it hasn't improved enough for them really to put their budgetary houses in order. Meanwhile, you know, someone told me once that Medicaid is a canary in the coal mine, which it is. Medicaid costs are going up. They're going up partly because Medicaid is working. More people are becoming uninsured because they're losing private health insurance from employers. So they're qualifying for Medicaid, and that's a good thing. But Medicaid costs are going up because healthcare inflation is going up. And as a result, Medicaid spending is going up faster than tax revenues are coming into the states. And that's not a good combination. So a number of states are looking this year at very deep cutbacks in Medicaid. Tennessee, of course, is one of them. And they've had one of the most generous programs in Medicaid in the United States. It's called 10Care. And their governor has proposed cutting over 300,000 people from that program.
Do you think it's politically easier for politicians to cut money from Medicaid than from Medicare?
The poor don't vote. And the poor don't count in Washington. They don't have strong advocacy groups like the AARP. They obviously don't have a lot of resources to influence the congressional process. They're not as organized. And so it's absolutely easier to cut Medicaid. And even though they had that sort of renaissance in the 1990s when Medicaid was growing, when the rubber meets the road and the economy gets in trouble, we see the first thing that they turn to is cutting Medicaid again. And they can't do it in Medicare.
You've written extensively about healthcare policy and specifically about the political life of Medicare and Medicaid. You don't hear that much discussion about, although we're all affected by healthcare policy, and we all have people in our family who are or will be affected by Medicare, it's not the national obsession when it comes to debate and talk shows and everything. And I suspect it's because these kinds of policy issues are not that easy to talk about. They're kind of complicated in every way. So they don't make for the greatest like spin debates or anything. And I'm wondering if that's a source of frustration to you.
Are you saying that I'm not going to be asked back anytime soon? Yeah, you know, I wish as a country we did spend more time on this. And I think in particular, I think we spend a fair amount of time on Medicare. We could do a better job in terms of the quality, if not the quantity. But we don't spend nearly enough time talking about Medicaid and talking about the uninsured. And one of the problems we have politically is that 15% of the country does not have health insurance, 45 million people. But 85% of the country does. And for a lot of us who have health insurance, we're not losing sleep at night about what's happening to those who are uninsured or what's happening to people on the Medicaid program. And most people are healthy. Most people are healthy. And so these issues simply don't resonate with them until it's too late, until it really matters and they've got a relative in the hospital or they need to go in the hospital themselves. So yes, I am. That's a long way of saying I am frustrated.
Jonathan Oberlander, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jonathan Oberlander is the author of The Political Life of Medicare. He's an associate professor of social medicine in the School of Medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.